Thanks everyone for listening to episode 22. As most of our listeners already are aware, episode 22, the original file on my computer, was somehow lost in the wind. But I was able to recover portions of the file and have re-recorded the other portions. I don't believe that it's exactly the same as the episode 22 that we actually recorded to begin with, which was fantastic. But I do think I did a pretty good job in getting everything up and running again. Enjoy! Welcome to the Fourth Age, a Wheel of Time podcast, brought to you by DragonMount.com.
The Wheel of Time is an epic fantasy series that is written by Robert Jordan.
Currently, there are 11 main books in the series and one prequel novel.
Robert Jordan is working on the final book, currently titled A Memory of Light.
And the Fourth Age podcast is dedicated to that series.
To contact us, please visit our website at www.dragonmount.com/podcast.
Hello everyone, I'm Jay, your podcast host. Welcome to episode 22. We again have a full house, and I will be talking about chapters 1 through 4 from my Wheel of Time journal. Yes, I know it's a short week for me, but I am a slacker, only 4 chapters. Let me remind everyone, I am not the webmaster for DragonMount.com. Although we're good friends, I host the podcast, and he was the one that created DragonMount. Guess who else we have with us this week?
Hi, everybody. My fan feedback of the week will be about our character of the week, which is Luke, Issam, and Slayer. Characters merged into character, I guess we should say. Also, Ben is joining us.
Hey, everyone. I've got a great crazy theory having to do with the Dark One and the Taint. It's very interesting. Coming up after that, Andrew is going to talk about some Wheel of Time news.
Hello, everyone. In the Wheel of Time news, Robert Jordan has updated his blog. It's been a while since we've heard from Mr. Jordan, and he has quite a bit to say. I'll be going over some of the bigger points, but if you would like to read the whole post, you can find it at www.dragonmount.com/Robert Jordan. The man's name is capitalized, of course. Here is some of what you'll find during the post. The news from the Mayo Clinic. Another drop in light lambda chains. This one time it was roughly about a 25% decrease. This leaves me in double digits, barely, but closing on the normal range of roughly between 1 and 3. This despite having been pulled off of Remlimid during the second hospital stay because my kidney numbers had gone wonky. Life is one little adventure after another around here. I asked how the study was going in general, were others getting the same good response that I was. My answer was a shrug, and a reply that other numbers were all over the place. The luck holds. You might find a small interest that I codified a list of things to be done once I regained 1. Overall strength, 2. Hand-eye coordination, and 3. Some degree of balance. I am convinced that I will recover these. The strength seems the easiest. And I have even agreed, after some urging from Harriet, to submit my hands and feet to acupuncture. Go figure. Me, the great skeptic. Well, she's a cousin of sorts, through marriage. It can get complicated in Charleston, and she is fully qualified, and all of that. Anyway, the list. Number 1, purchase Harley. Number 2, skydiving qualification. I'm not talking buddy jumping strapped to some guy's belly like a kangaroo trying to escape from its mother's pouch. I mean to take the whole 9 yards so that I can walk into any place where such a thing is possible, rent a chute, rent a plane to take me up, and go jump, no questions asked. Number 3, take up ballroom dancing lessons with Harriet. Funny, after saying that I don't hold on to regrets, that I should come to this one straight away. You see, before I began having nerve problems, my feet, and loss of balance, I was a pretty good dancer. Good enough to have 20-something guys complimenting me on my moves, and women of various ages cutting in on Harriet to dance with me. It was also neat to be addressed on the street, sometimes by a woman I could swear I had never met in my life, with cries of, "Hello, dancer!" Well, I want that back. Number 4, take up golf. This is something I had just begun to get into when things went bluey in general. You need balance to make a good swing, and I found out that I have a pretty good natural talent for the game. After this, Robert Jordan added an extra little bit. Before I tell you what it is, though, I do want to say that this is a possible spoiler from the mouth of the creator himself. So if you don't want this spoiler from Robert Jordan, you might want to turn your sound down for about 3 minutes or so. Robert Jordan said this after concluding his list. Oh, and finish A Memory of Light, of course. And getting started on Matt and Tuan and some others 5 to 10 years after the last battle. We're all looking at what, was said there, and it's kind of an interesting thing. Is this alluding to a spin-off story or a companion piece to The Wheel of Time? Is Robert Jordan trying to connect Wheel of Time with Infinity of Heaven, the next series he's planning on writing? We do know that the culture in that is supposed to be similar to the Shanshan, so what do you guys think about that?
Well, I think he definitely gave us confirmation right there that both Matt and Tuan are both going to survive the last battle. I think that's very important. That's really the only confirmation that we know for 100% sure what's going to happen. They're definitely going to have some kind of life together after Tahrimon Gaiden. They're going to survive. We'll see what others are.
I was just trying to find where it said it, like his exact words, because to me, when I read it originally, I thought that it was saying that I took it as that it was meaning like some type of sequel or something. That was just the way I took it, but I hope he could mean, maybe, do you think, in A Memory of Light, that he's going to be doing a short little blurb about everybody 5 to 10 years later? But I think that it's like another book. I don't know.
Well, he talked about the Outrigger novels, but he also said that usually an idea like that has to stew around in his head for a year or so to make sure it's a good idea. So I don't think it's going to be an Outrigger. I think it's just going to be maybe like a an epilogue where it's going to talk about it in Memory of Life. That's my opinion, because if it's an entire another book. It seems awfully early for him to start writing on it,
I know. This is exactly what he says. He says, oh, finishing A Memory of Light, of course, and getting started on Matt and Tuon and some others 5 to 10 years after the last battle. So he says, finishing A Memory of Light, of course, and getting started on Matt and Tuon. If Matt and Tuon were included in that, wouldn't it be finishing A Memory of Light with Matt and Tuon and some others?
It's true,
right?
Yeah.
Right? I don't know.
it's obviously not going to be part of the prequels, because it's, after.
Exactly.
So I guess the only thing we can conclude, really, is that it's those Outrigger novels that he was talking about, and apparently he's stewed over it enough and decided to go with it, which is cool with me. I mean, he can write as much as he wants in the Wheel of Time series, and I will read every word he writes.
Oh, I love Matt and Tuon. I love Matt, and I love Matt and Tuon together. I don't like Tuon so much because she annoys me, but I love the two of them together, just the interaction between them.
Welcome to Jason's Wheel of Time Journal. Thanks for listening to Jason's Wheel of Time Journal. I'm going to be covering this week chapters 1 through 4 of The Great Hunt. To start off, we are with Rand and Lon on top of one of the towers. Rand is still there, even though he said he was leaving a month ago. A bubble of evil pushes Rand as he's practicing with Lon, and Lon is teaching him. The Almorillan seat shows up. Rand is moved through the keep, and everyone keeps saying that the Almorillan seat is there for him, and him specifically. Rand tries to leave through the stablemen, but the stablemen won't allow him to leave. He says that he has received orders. Rand tries to leave then through the gates, but he's not allowed to leave through there either. Rand runs into Matt, Perrin, and Loyal, where Matt discovers his luck at dice. And Ben, I'm going to have to call you out on this. This is well before Matt sounds the Horn of Valair. So the Horn of Valair does not specifically or directly, indirectly, in any way really, as far as I can see, contribute to Matt's luck. Rand tries to make them angry, so they won't follow him. This is a thing that he does many, many times later in the books. He leaves, and he runs into Egwene, and she decides to hide in the dungeon where Fane is. They have a conversation where Fane mentions Mordeth, which is a clue later in the books of to the two of them merging. Egwene decides to hide Rand in the women's apartments. Moving on to Moiraine's point of view, we're introduced to two new Aes Sedai, Liandrin and Inalia. Liandrin of the Red and Inalia of the Blue. Basically, in this chapter, we're introduced also to the 13 other Aes Sedai that come with Swan. It gets confusing here, as a lot of different characters introduced. They start talking politics, this and that, and the other thing. But the main thing I took away from this chapter is that they do mention and reflect on the strengths of the three girls, Egwene, Nynaeve, and Elaine. They all seem to be like leeches. They're all trying to claim them, saying, oh, we're going to have this one for the red, we'll have this one for the blue. We also learn that Swan and Moiraine are friends and have been planning something well before they meet in these two books. They've been planning something big. But comments, what do you guys, what do you remember from the first four chapters of The Great Hunt?
Well, I know personally, one of the things that really stuck out is really obvious what Rand is doing from the very beginning with Matt and Perrin and Loyal. It's really obvious he is thoroughly convinced that he's going to just go mad and he might hurt somebody, so he's trying to get away from them. And then we get this later scene where it's introduced to Liandrin, and I just, from the moment I met her, I just said, this person's not right. You know, even reds that we've seen before, like Elida, weren't as, just outright as snappish and basically nearly evil, frankly, for lack of a better term. But those are the real things that really caught me at first. And that and Fane was creepy.
Yeah, definitely. I agree about Leandrin, and I always had a dislike for her and thought, even before, obviously, as rereading, I know what happened, but before I knew that she was actually Black Aja, I just had this like hate for her. I don't know what it was. She just is cold, and you could tell that there was something not right with her by the way that she was, I'm not sure if it was in these first four chapters, but when Lord Algemar's sister, that she was like bullying her and trying to get her to,
yeah, just manipulated her and used compulsion on her,
yeah, like to get them, all the women, to search for Rand. And she was just very sneaky. I didn't like the way she went about anything. She was just, I didn't trust her. I didn't like anything about her. So I completely agree about that.
No, I don't really think that anybody really trusts her or likes anything about her. I think as me being a reader, I thought, the first time that I read the books, I was thinking, well, maybe this is the way all Aes Sedai are. Maybe the legends about Aes Sedai are true. Maybe they are conniving, and maybe they never say what they're meaning to say in an evil way too. She definitely is doing things in an evil way, and we don't know. As I said earlier, we don't know for sure that compulsion is a sign of something that of an Aes Sedai who's evil. She uses it right here. Blatantly, and reading it a second and third time, we know now exactly what that means. But besides Liandrin and how much everybody hates her, this is also the chapters where we're introduced to Matt's luck, and I believe Ben had a theory where Matt's luck comes from Matt blowing the Horn of Valyr, but Matt actually has his luck at the beginning, not just at the end. So Ben, your theory was that his luck came from the horn. What do you think? Are you going to retract your statement, or are you going to stick by it?
I will defend my position lightly, because I will say, at the time he's with them, the Horn of Valyr is in their possession. So the Horn of Valyr is there in the camp, in, you know, the castle place, with the blower. He hasn't blown it yet, but he's still, you know, I think we could still say that the way the Wheel of Time works, it's a circular pattern, so he's still the blower of the horn, whether he's blown it at that particular time or not. So I still think that's why he has the ability to have all that luck. I think that's where it's coming from.
I'm just going to add, just because I had just read it, so I think it's just, I was reading, I was just at the end of the dragon, or at the end of the dragon, the Great Hunt and the beginning of the Dragon Reborn, but I think it was the Dragon Reborn where they mentioned that Ardor Hawkwing being the greatest Teverin before, like, Rand, Matt, and Perrin, that there was a time when they said that all dice fell his way. I'm not, like, big on dice. I don't know, but it always went his way. So that, to me, is a little symbol that it could have something to do with the Teverin being why he's so lucky and not the
Horn. It's very possible, although I just can't. I'm so defensive about my theories. What can I say? I'll admit it. I'm defensive. Maybe I'm insecure. But also, if that were true, if Teverin was the cause of the luck, then Rand and Perrin would have it also. But they don't. And what we do have from Rand is the dice thundering in his head. And
Matt, yeah.
And, you know, whenever Matt blows the horn of Valyr, Ardor Hawkwing is summoned, and he's the lucky guy. So, you know, that can't lose a throw of the dice. Matt can't even do that. He loses some of them, which is good. So, I still defend my theory. I'm standing by my guns.
Welcome to Ben's Crazy Theory of the Week.
Yes, it is crazy theory time, and don't forget, there are spoilers from this part of the show on. Actually, pretty much the entire show has spoilers. You probably have figured that out by now, but specifically these parts right here. Don't want to say you weren't warned, but spoiler warning, there it is. You know about it now, so you can't say anything else. All right, moving on to this crazy theory. This crazy theory is actually taken from the DragonMount.com forums. It's in the section called A Memory of Light. I think that's the little heading it's under. And it is posted by, oh, I can't even remember the guy's name. I should have wrote it down. But I think it was like the Great Dice or something like that. So I took his theory that he wrote on there. He articulated his theory the best. And so I'm going to read to you a little bit of what he wrote in that post. I believe that the taint on Sidene was the true power, or at least residue of it. My theory goes something like this. The Dark One struck back at the Hundred Companions using his power source. We also know that from multiple point of views that the true power can cause madness even with the direct permission of the Dark One. I believe that the true power and the true source are anathema to each other. For those of you who don't know, anathema means cursed. Yeah, it's really strong, powerful, opposite of each other. Back to quoting, the true power and the Dark One's counterstrike reacted like oil poured onto water. It floated on top and caused an oil slick, if you will. The reason Rand's wound still pains him, even though the taint itself is gone, is that he has a connection with the only living true power user in the world. Moradin, Eshamael, Nablus, whatever you want to call him. Also, the connection is broke. Once the connection is broke, or Moradin or Eshamael is really dead, the wound will finally heal. Or at least that's my theory. So, all right, he's got a whole lot of theories sort of wrapped up into one here. And all of that might be difficult to follow it, so I'm going to sort of break it down a little bit. He believes that the taint on Sidene was the true power, or at least a residue like this. The Dark One struck back at the Hundred Companions using his power source. Well, that's not too hard to believe that the Dark One would strike back using his power source. He supports this by saying we know that that Moradin Eshamael went mad whenever he was using actually, it wasn't Moradin then, it was Eshamael, went mad from using the true power all throughout throughout his time, during the time he was partially free. In books 1-3, basically, is whenever he was free, sort of roaming the earth, and that he was sort of mad, and that other characters have said that using the true source, or the true power, rather, makes you go mad. So it makes sense, and it sort of seems to follow. I don't think that using the taint was actually literally the true power. I think that it might be some sort of it might have some sort of component of the true power, that it was caused by the true power, but I don't think that it is actually simply using it, because if that were the case, I believe that you would be able to, that Rand wouldn't have been able to filter it out using Sidar. Whenever he cleansed the taint in Book 9, he sort of used Sidar as a conduit and sort of filtered out all of that stuff, and it seemed he filtered out all of the taint, and to me it seems like the taint was more of a substance rather than a, you know, an element of power. I don't think he could have done, you know, you can't coat Sidine with Sidar, you know, if you take the same types of theories, you know. Let's see, how do I say this? You can't take Sidine and put a little coat of Sidine over Sidar. Well, if that were true with the true power, then that you ought to, then the same should hold true. I hope I explained that well, but so that's why I don't think that's really the way the physics of it work. Now, I'll move on a little bit. The reason Rand's wound still pains him, even though the taint is gone, is that he has a connection with the only living true power user in the world, Moradin Ishamael. Whenever they were fighting at the end of Book 2, and Rand sheathed his sword and got... I didn't sheathe the sword. I can't remember the move that he did, but he let Moradin cut him, and he really got him, got the home run blow in. But the connection he has is with the wound, obviously, and if that were the case, I actually disagree with this theory completely. I think it's wrong. If that were true, whenever he killed him the first time, then he would have, then the wound would have been gone right away. It would have just healed up immediately afterwards. Because I don't believe that as soon as Ishamael was killed, the Dark One instantly reincarnated him as Moradin. It's possible, but it just doesn't seem to fit. He shows up way too late in the book. He doesn't show up again till I think Book 6 is whenever he shows up again, and he dies in Book 3. So that's two books where he's entirely out of the picture, not doing anything, and there's a lot going on. So I think he would be gone for that time. I think that's not too hard to imagine that he would be gone wherever dead people go, talking with the Dark One, having tea or whatever. All right, so if the connection, in his theory, if the connection would have been broken whenever Moradin or Ishamael was really dead, then it would have been broken immediately after he died in Book 3 and would have reestablished itself suddenly and violently in Book 7 or 6 whenever he came back. That wasn't the case. Rand's wound has been a constant thing throughout Books 4 and 5 whenever we had no mention of Moradin Ishamael. So that's why I think that theory is busted. What do you guys think on all of that long monologue?
I don't really think there's really too much that myself personally can add to it. I think you hit all the points exactly right. Good job with the crazy theory. You were very, very, very thorough. What about Carrie and Andrew? What do you two think?
I think it's a really a well thought out theory, though.
I definitely
think it's
well
a very
out.
Good theory. But there's a lot of things that we can kind of take. Like you already said, pretty much anything that I would say. But
you know, there's elements of truth to it. I think with the true power and everything. But yeah. I think it's still a little off.
I think definitely.
Yeah, yeah. We all agree, and
everybody agrees with me? Wow.
Whoa.
That, that won't last. Guarantee you that won't last.
Welcome to Carrie's Fan Feedback of the Week. Thanks to Justin for this email that we got. Actually, it was quite a long email, and he gave us some great links to some different sites and everything, which... some of us already have saved in our favorites because we go there quite often. I'd just like to point out a few things that he said. And his first question would be, why would Gitara Moroso Sedai send Tigraine to the Owl Waste, a good thing, and then send Luke to the Blight to become something so horrible? Why would she send him to his doom? Also, he says that that Luke, or sorry, that whole Luke and Ism combination kind of confuses me. And what will his part of the last battle be? Does he have any control over the Darkhounds? He has a theory also that Luke could channel and was a good guy. He met Issam in the high passes and killed him. Fades and dark side channelers and captured him and turned him to the dark side, as any channeler is vulnerable to. The Dark One then put Issam's soul into Luke's body, another Dark One joke, he says, and to become Slayer, an assassin for the dark. So there's kind of a couple little interesting things, like, can Luke channel? Because that kind of would seem to be the only way for him to be turned to the dark. I never got the feeling that before he was sent away, while he was just, you know, the prince, that he was a bad guy in any way. What would make him change? Unless he was a channeler and done exactly like Justin says.
Yeah, I think you mentioned it, especially in book three, I think is wherever we first, in fact, I think it's the only mention of it, wherever it says that in order for you to be turned to the dark side, that you have to be the dark side. That sounds so Star Wars.
I know.
Towards the dark
side. That's what
one.
I said when I was,
you get
when
the
I was,
idea.
When I was reading it, I was thinking.
You get
that.
The idea. But in order to be turned like that, you have to be able to channel. I think Varen, it's Varen or Swan, I can't remember, but they're mentioning it to Egwene whenever they're going after the Black Aja in Tyr, and they say that being able to channel leaves you vulnerable to all of that, and she goes on and has a pretty long explanation of it, but I think that's where we do learn that you have to be able to channel in order to be turned so completely. I mean, the character of Slayer is so twisted and turned that it really sort of describes the way Robert Jordan has talked about.
Because they never show anything about him being able to channel, but it just seems to me that since he's always entering the world of dreams in the flesh, that we've never seen anybody who cannot channel enter the world of dreams in the flesh. Not a man, anyway.
I guess it could be. Yeah, go ahead.
It's just definitely kind of.
It could be with what happened that the Aiel wise ones warned Egwene of, that this is actually the result of him entering Teleron Riad in the flesh too often, that, you know, he's sort of gotten messed up because of it.
Yeah, because it does. They did say that you lose. I'm pretty sure that the wording was in the books that you lose a part of your soul when you enter in the flesh. So maybe that's what turned him evil of some.
It could be.
Why do you think that Gitera Moroso would send him to the Blight? Do you guys think that it has anything to do with, I don't know. Obviously she had a foretelling about Tigraine and she sent her away.
Well, I was kind of fuzzy about that. I seem to remember when Jatara had her foretelling, was it me or wasn't Luke already there? I thought he was like doing some sort of like training thing, like the Borderlanders who go up into the Blight to, you know, hunt Trollocs and whatnot. And I thought he was already gone by the time she fled into the Waste. I'm not sure one way or the other, but
I think he was gone for a year or something.
Couldn't remember.
It's very, the whole thing is, there's so many questions that we could go on. We do have a voicemail, too, that I would like to put in, because we have, obviously, since we're doing Look and Issam and the whole Slayer thing, this one relates to that. And I would like to thank Jamel for sending this in.
Hello, my name is Jamel, and I've been reading the Wheel of Time series also and listening to your podcast. And the reason for my call is that in your last podcast, when you were talking about Issam and Lord Luck, I think what many people are missing is that Lord Luck only appears in the real world, where Issam only appears in Teleron Riad, which is the world of dreams. And I think they were both either taken there in the flesh and therefore merged in the world of dreams. And that's why one only appears in the real world and the other only appears in the world of dreams. but they do have a dualistic nature. And I think that is helping to explain what is also happening between Rand and Moradin.
Thanks, Jamel. One thing, I guess, it makes a lot of sense in the beginning of the books that Luke is the one in the real world and Isim in the world of dreams, because that's all we see. But in Winter's Heart, actually, we pretty much learn a little bit different. We know that Luke is in the world of dreams because Elaine and Egwene see him, and they make mention that they think that it could be Rand's uncle if he had an angry uncle or something like that. So we know that Luke can be in the world of dreams as well. Also, I know that when there was one point in Winter's Heart where Isam was going to... He was in the world of dreams and he was stepping out, and he thought he was on his way to assassinate Rand and Min. And he says, I think in order to do this, to kill my nephew, I think he says, I will take the form of Luke or something. Or he becomes Luke anyway, right before he steps out. So basically he's saying that he's going to take the form. He's not saying he has to take the form. That's like his choice. It's also known that we learn later on in the books that I think it's Winter's Heart too, that Isim is the one who killed the two Aes Sedai. What was it? Joya.
The two in the Stone of Tear.
Emiko or something? Yeah. Though I couldn't remember their name. Joya and Emiko, and they were in the Stone of Tear, and it was Isim that actually killed them. So obviously Isim can be in the waking world, and Luke can go into the world of dreams, although I think they can only change from one to the other in the world of dreams. It's kind of an interesting theory, though, that they merged in the world of dreams, and that's how they became Slayer. Maybe that's where he gets all his power from, like you said earlier. Maybe that's why, because he lost parts of his... they lost parts of their soul from entering it. Maybe that's why they're so evil. I don't know. Not really sure, but it's interesting.
Yeah. Well, and honestly, that...
Definitely.
That the voicemail, and thanks again to Jamel, really leads really well into the character of this week, who is Luke / Isam, who we commonly know as Slayer from our Contact with the Wolves. That's our character of the week, and the first reference tying Luke and Isam together in any way actually comes from a piece of dark prophecy. It's scrawled on the walls in Faldara after the Trolloc raid. The relevant stanza is in Chapter 7 of the Great Hunt, called Blood Calls Blood. What the prophecy, or the relevant part of the prophecy, says is this: Luke came to the Mountains of Doom. Isam waited in the High Passes. The hunt is now begun. The Shadow's hounds now course and kill. One did live and one did die, but both are. The time of change has come. Which is really interesting. And the talk about the Shadow's hounds, I think, is where the earlier... commentary asked, you know, can he control the Dark Hounds? And I never actually caught that or
Justin
even thought
asked,
about that,
yeah.
I think. So it was really interesting.
Yeah, I think that's where it comes from.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's just in that passage.
It's one of the really interesting powers thoughts that is in the Wheel of Time, that he can control the hounds. Very, very interesting. I hope to hear more in the last book, but we're going to try and break down Luke, Slayer, and Isam, because I think that for a lot of people that read the books, and, you know, for myself too, it is very, very confusing.
Me too.
Yeah, it is very confusing.
It's complex.
It's complex, absolutely. What I'm going to do is break down the connection between Isam, Luke, Slayer. Isam is Lan's cousin. His father was killed, and then his mother tried to make him king. The plot actually ended up failing, and they fled south. We know they were overtaken by Trollocs, but we did not find, neither of their bodies were found, so we would assume that they lived. Luke is Rand's uncle on his mother's side. He was the one that killed Rand's father. We know this because Rand's father did not defend himself because Luke looked so much like Rand's mother. Slayer is a combination of Luke and Isom, kind of like Podan Fain and Mordith, but not exactly. They have separate identities and separate bodies, and they're controlled by Slayer, a combination of the two. Luke and Isom met in the High Passes. One of them died and one lived. Luke is... some more information. Luke is seen in the Two Rivers. He looks like Rand. This is Slayer as Luke. Perrin meets Slayer as Isom in the dream world. Perrin shoots Slayer Isom with an arrow, and he runs off hurt. And Luke also runs off hurt at the same time, so this is how we know that they're both, in fact, the same. So what does everybody else think? I mean, I know it's very confusing, isn't it?
One thing that's kind of weird is how it does say in that passage that one dies while the other lives, because I'm pretty sure in the books we've seen the point of view from both Luke and Isam, because we've heard him mention his nephew in the Wench, which is obviously Luke's point of view because Rand is his nephew, and then we've heard things from Isam's point of view as well. So if they're dead, if one of them is dead, which one is it? Because they're both walking around, and obviously their soul, part of their soul is still there too. That's kind of weird. I don't understand that part. Does it make sense to you guys?
It does. I think the question is, how exactly did this happen?
That's just crazy.
That's the $64,000 question to me. I think the entire key to like all of the stuff that's happened. We can figure out, you know, this person's, you know, correlates with this one, and he did this and did that. But the big question, I still think Robert Jordan hasn't answered or hasn't given us enough clues to figure out, because that's the big question to me.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, and that and. When I think Perrin is initially chasing Slayer in the dream, and I'm just going to use the word Slayer because figuring out which of the two of them it was beforehand is just kind of awkward. During the first time Perrin encounters Slayer in the world of dreams, Slayer runs off and he runs into the Tower of Genji, the place that is the portal to the Elfin and the Elfin world. And I was always, I don't know, some part of me, I guess, always kind of considered, well, maybe they did something to him. Like, maybe there was, up in the Blight, there was another kind of Tower of Genji, and they were fighting, and they fell into it or something. I don't know. It was kind of interesting.
Oh, so you think there might be more than
one? There might be. I mean, there were two door frames, Turangriel. Maybe
exactly.
There are two different towers.
Maybe one goes... I'm pretty sure Bridget said it goes into both lands, but maybe one of the towers goes in to the Elfin and the other goes into the Elfin.
But
The question that I have is, why is he the only character in the Wheel of Time that we've seen so far that can go in and out at will?
He must have some tie to it or link to it. Maybe his merging had something to do with the tower itself, because why else would he be able to get into it so easily? And he escapes it no problem. It's not like he's trapped there like Moraine. Well, no, she didn't enter that way, but, you know, Bridget warns Perrin of it. So maybe it's something that the Elfin did to him. But I seem to think it's something more to do with the Dark One, the way he's his assassin and everything. But it's just so... The part that's hard about Slayer is that we have all these questions and we really don't have any answers. It's just complete theorizing and guessing, because we don't really know too much about him.
Yeah, it's true. I think, you know, he's going to have to show up again. And I think that something that Matt and Tom and all... and I can't remember the other guy, but the other guy that's going with them to the Tower of Genji, they're probably going to have to defeat Slayer in order to get Moraine. That's my theory, is that they're going to have to... Yeah, he'll be there in the tower, and they'll have to get past him or kill him or deal with him in order to get Moraine out alive.
Wow, that's... Ben, I think you just came up with your own crazy theory. Wow, that would be extremely, extremely interesting, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I was just going to say, yeah, I should have saved that one, man.
Yeah, that's good, because I was going to say, Justin, who we got the email from earlier, had asked, you know, what we think his role in the last battle will be. Well, if your theory is correct, he won't be in the last battle.
No, he wouldn't be in the last battle. It would be interesting if the last book started off with a rescue mission, going to save Moraine and getting to there has to be something preventing them from just walking in and getting him. So I think probably Luke Slayer Isom would be the person that would try and stop him.
I never really thought he was going to be in the actual last battle itself, because they have to deal with Taim and his renegades and everybody, you know, I mean, but...
There's so much
that would be interesting. Just wait till after book 12 comes out, and then, Ben, you could say if you were right.
Yes, I will.
You could go and shout it off the rooftops. Woo-hoo! And just everyone can, woo, I was right.
We should, in fact, we should do that. We should, make a little list of, some of our predictions and... for future podcasts, and then, you know, right before book 12 comes out, see who gets them right, and we can, you know, have a little mini contest between us four.
See who gets gloating rights?
Yes. Let's start writing down our
exactly
theories.
Exactly.
Well, I think I know what one of our, you know, future podcasts are going to be about. Theories that we've thought about and written down. But anyway, this actually finishes up our discussion of Luke Isom Slayer. I truly do hope that everyone is more educated and has a better understanding of the connection between the three.
Next week, yes, next week we have the one discussion that has been torturing you, that's kept you up late at night, the reason you haven't been able to sleep, wondering who killed Asmodian. We've sort of teased this for a while, but next week is going to be the episode. Depending on how it goes, we're not sure yet whether we're going to have one or two episodes, but we're going to do however long it takes in order to hopefully answer all of your questions, cover every single possible facet of this discussion. So we need to hear what you have to say for it. So email us, write us. You can go to the forums and post your theories, all of them, crazy, not crazy, everything that you might have read that Robert Jordan has posted about it. I know a lot of people have been talking about the CNN transcript. We'll talk more about that. Go to the forums, tell us what you think, and you can post in Jason's post. It's called Episode 23.
Also, guys, don't forget, not only do you have our forums in a way of getting in contact with us, but you can also phone us at 1-888-333, that's easier to say, sorry, I hope it's not confusing for you, 7690, and leave us a voicemail message. Also, you can send in your fan feedback through email. You can record yourself on our MySpace page that we have. There's all different kinds of way to get in contact with us, so please don't forget to send us in your feedback.
And of course, for our very special Asmodean episode or episodes, don't forget to email us at podcast@dragonmount.com.
Thanks everyone for listening. We really do appreciate all the listeners. Till next time.
Take care, everyone.
See you next time.
And walk in the light.
The Fourth Age Podcast is brought to you by DragonMount.com. For advertising, please email advertising@dragonmount.com. The music for our podcast is brought to you by Josh Edelman. You can visit his site at www.scriberocks.com. Wow, guys, that was a fantastic, fantastic show. Everybody did such a great job. Wow, I really hope our listeners liked that one. I hope we broke it down good. Wow, fantastic. That's the only word that I have to say.
I just wanted to giggle all the way through that whole thing.
Oh, yeah. I keep wanting to find something that fits in the old tongue just to spout out there at the end so people are like, what the hell did he just say? But you never know. Oh, shoot, I forgot to stop recording.